Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Bored of too many ads and dull, meaningless chat? We've got neither. Joy Drive, smart, fun radio. Planes, trains and all the must-sees. Joy Drive travel.
Chris Dyer, good afternoon.
It's so weird. I'm here on a
Friday. We're confusing our drive family.
Confusing me, Con. You're confusing me.
Because you sort of came in and you go, oh my gosh, I don't know which day it is. Because I know you've been travelling and it's just like you've been here, there and everywhere.
It is one of those things that I'm still on a little bit of jet lag. So
I know.
I'm kind of like, my body thinks it's like 2 a.m.
Well, I'm aware of your travel plans coming up in not too distant future. And I've got to lean the opportunity while you're still in the country to sort of have you on. Thank you for making the time to come in on a Friday, because usually we don't treat ourselves to travel. Let's just jump into some travel news, because there's some things that you want to talk about.
Yeah.
What's the first one?
So there's some interesting stuff has happened this week, and particularly with Qantas. So Qantas have actually announced some changes to their Qantas frequent flyer program. Okay. And why this is important is 15.2 million Australians have a Qantas frequent flyer profile.
Wow.
People are using this program a lot. And what the Qantas have been accused of in the past is not actually having a lot of reward flights, or when you go to redeem, they're quite expensive. So they have two programs in place at the moment, which is just like a classic seat, and they're rare as hen's teeth. They're really difficult to get hold of. Or then you have a points plus pay option, and that actually ends up being really expensive, and you end up spending a lot more on your points. So what they have done now is they've created a new scheme, which is called the Classic Plus Flight Reward.
And I'm going to guess that sort of what sits between.
What's interesting about this is they've put a value on each frequent flyer mile. So your economy seat is 1 point, is one frequent flyer mile is worth 1 cent, and your business seat is 1.5 cents.
Okay.
So what will happen is flights will actually fluctuate in terms of prices. So it'll go up and down, but you will know the value of what you're spending in terms of the seat price, because you know that the actual value of the flight mile. That it's very, very, very unique in terms of its program. I quite like it because it kind of sits in the middle and it kind of solves a problem. I also like it because they're going to be offering 20 million reward seats.
Wow. And I'm guessing what's been the motivation is obviously Qantas is getting a lot of flack. Old CEO, it's out the door, and we've got the new CEO and reinvigorating the brand. And this is one of the key things they want to sort of...
Yeah, and like with all travel brands, they're trying to create this customer loyalty, right? So they're trying to make sure that they can retain, you know, it's hard to get a new customer. So this is all about retaining and making the current customer base really, really happy. As I said, I think that this transparency is really good. If you want to compare it to points plus pay, you're looking at about 6 cents for every flight mile versus the 1 cent for economy. So it's a lot more economical. The rewards flights will start rolling out domestically at the end of this year and then internationally into 2025. So I find it's quite an interesting program.
And I think the key thing is here, is which surprised me, is that they have 15.2 million frequent flyers. Considering the country has got 25 or 26 million people, that's a substantial amount of people who have signed up this program.
And it's our national carrier, and we do really identify with it, and we feel a sense of ownership of it as well. So when it is going really, really wrong, I think that kind of hurts our own national pride as well. But this is a really interesting one, and it's about this brand trying to stay competitive in the marketplace as well.
I love having you unpacked it, because I'm just thinking I sort of heard about the program, but it became a little bit kind of complex to break down, and you've sort of done it. So that's really good. So the uptake is it fits between two other existing programs. There are going to be more seats offered.
Correct.
And it will sort of not cannibalize people's using up all their points.
Yeah. They've done a bit of math out there in terms of, so it looks like an international flight will cost you around about 120,000 points on a non-busy leg, and that's sort of a trip from sort of Melbourne to London, and that's one way. But you will also just be mindful you're going to have to pay taxes on top of that. So they'll still slug you with like a $400 fee at about the end of the end of the actual transaction, because that is obviously can't be covered on points.
Fair enough. So that's the new frequent flyer program there. The other thing I want to talk about is you've just come back from the US, hence a little bit of jet lag, not knowing where you're here, there, or everywhere, which time zone you're in.
Exactly.
Now, one big thing that made the news, and nice piece was covered over there, because obviously it was a situation that was going on in a particular part of the world, is a solar eclipse.
It was.
What was that all about?
Con, it was friggin' mental. They were crazy for it. I know, like, I'm going to generalize a little bit here. I know Americans can go a little bit over the top on, you know, certain events, but they were gagging for this eclipse. It was so odd. So, and part of the reason was because it was the trajectory of the eclipse.
Right.
It took in some really interesting cities. So the way that it kind of went up. So all the way down from Dallas in Texas, so places like Cleveland and Indianapolis, right through to Montreal up in Canada, in terms of the way this kind of window where the eclipse was going to be visible from. What I found interesting is the data. I love data, and the data has just come out that about 5 million people traveled to see the eclipse.
Wow.
There was something like 95% occupancy of Airbnbs within that like window of where the eclipse was going to happen, and it's going to generate what they think $1.5 billion of tourism money into those economies, which I find absolutely extraordinary for a phenomenon that happens in the sky for not that long.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay. Sort of like, and you sort of said people just went really well over the top with it because it was coverage was massive.
It was the lead story in nearly every news bulletin as you were watching the television. They had sold out of the eclipse goggles. Yep. It was that, you know, they were selling badges and t-shirts and banners and capes and like, I survived the eclipse of 2024. Okay. It was just crazy. And lots of travel warnings, you know, on the day of in terms of just making sure that you weren't kind of trapped in the chaos. I find it fabulous and fascinating, and I find as humans we're really, really funny when we come to this sort of stuff, but I do kind of love it because it is my travel world.
I love it too. So they were fortunate enough to have the eclipse. Is there one that's on the horizon for, speaking of horizons, when's the next one sort of main expected to hit?
So you can do, so you can start some planning. It's 2026, so right. It's August the 12th. There is going to be a total solar eclipse, but it will only be visible from Iceland, okay. Greenland, Spain, and parts of Portugal. So, you know, you've got enough time to plan for this. You know, we're giving nearly like 2 years worth of warning. Some of those places are quite difficult to get to, Greenland, for instance. Yes. But, you know, that's where the next one will be visible. So, and I think the next one in the States, you know, for those going nuts over there, they're just like, oh, it's not until like 2044. So,
well,
so it's a ways off then.
When it comes to sort of seeing this solar eclipse, like we know would have been the case a few days ago, or seeing it in a couple of years, and you've mentioned two of my favourite countries, I'll wait for 2 years' time and go there. And I'm sure the coverage will be a bit more balanced and people won't be as frenetic with it.
Who knows? Who knows? Con, who knows?
Chris, while we got you here, I thought we're going to delve deep. I reached out to people who want to ask you some travel questions because we got you for an extended period. And I think these are the things that a lot of us want to know. This is from Zia from Hawthorne. What's better when I'm making purchases when traveling overseas, a credit card or travel money card? What are the pros and cons? Also, when I make a payment, should I do it in local currency or Australian dollars?
Really good question. So the advantage of using a travel card is you will lock in your rate. You will lock in your exchange rate at that time. And so if you're topping up money onto your travel card, you are locking it into that rate. So if you get a really good exchange rate, it becomes quite an economical way of doing it.
Okay.
Absolutely pay in local currency. Do not actually, because they will often create a transfer fee on top of what you're already paying because they're transferring the dollars into your currency. currency that's on your card. So you do want to pay in the local currency, but just to avoid getting stung with additional fees. So there'll be fees on top of fees. I would highly advise also making sure that you have a card that has the Maestro symbol on the back. So that looks like the MasterCard symbol, but it's in the blue double circles.
Yep.
And that is the symbol that you look for at ATMs when you're overseas to withdraw cash, because there are a lot of places that still do want actually cash transactions. We're very used to tap and go here. Everything is kind of like on our phones, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a big one and still making sure that you have access to some cash, because if you're on a Greek island, you know, it may be just that's the transaction. That's the way that transactions occur.
And we can't sort of mention any sort of business that offers these travel cards, but they're quite widely available across
widely
all the banks.
Available. And I would do a little bit of a Google search. There are a couple of also comparison sites that will help you look at the pros and cons of each ones of the actual cards.
Okay.
So you can jump onto those comparison sites as well and actually do that deep dive. But I would highly advise using that as your best form of travel money.
Essentially, get a travel card, put the funds in there, and then enjoy the use of. And obviously, the fees are kept to the. You get the good exchange rate, hopefully you've locked in a good one, and the fees are kept to a bare minimum.
If they are, and you can then keep that same card, you can keep in your wallet on your phone and all those other bits and pieces as well. So it actually just acts as a similar card to what you've already got.
That's Zia from Hawthorne. Hopefully that's helped Zia. Ty in Daylesford. I'm heading to Ireland in May for a wedding and we'll have 48 hours in London. It'll be my first time there. Other than seeing a few of the main sites, and I'm guessing we all know them, it's Big Ben or Buckingham Palace. What's a really good way to spend it there to get a true flavour of the city?
Oh, Consi, I'd avoid Big Ben and Buckingham Palace.
All right, okay, there you go.
I kind of find that they're a little bit of tourist traps. You kind of see them and it's just kind of like, One thing I would do is the London Eye is pretty amazing because you get this incredible perspective of the city and of the river just because of where the actual, where the Ferris wheel is actually located. So I think that's a great way of doing things. It's centrally located as well. So definitely one that I would absolutely say do. I think they're going into some of the more places like Borough Market, which is on the other side. It's on the south side of the Thames. Really great experience because you see all these vendors and there's great, you know, coffee shops and all those kind of other bits and pieces. Fantastic way of experiencing kind of loud, noisy, rambunctious London. I love it. And right next to it is Bermondsey, and that feels like a little village. So you've got little like pubs, and you feels like you're in a country town. And there's a great kind of brewery mile that goes along the alcoves within the train depot.
Wow.
So really, really, that's very cool. So Bermondsey, London Eye. The other one that I do is I'd consider doing a day trip. So maybe actually to consider doing a day trip out to kind of one of the castles on the train, actually getting a glimpse of the countryside. May is beautiful because you're starting to get into that kind of like late spring, early summer. It's not school holidays, so it's not super populated. But I think that, one day looking around the city. Oh, and the other thing, see a show. Oh, my God. Okay. So you absolutely must see a show because they do the half tick stuff, and there's really great performances, and we want to support live artists where we can. So definitely see a London show too.
Love that, Ty and Dallas. Hopefully that answers. We've got a question from Katie in Collingwood. Is there a day in the week? I think this is a cost of living question that we all sort of ponder. Is there a day in the week or the month that's best to look at for booking flights? How far ahead? This is a few questions. How far ahead should I look to book a flight? Do you always get good deals when you book in advance or a few weeks before? And also, are there any deals that you know that are happening at the moment for flights to Europe? Gosh, it's all about value, trying to find with here sort of...
Katie has a lot of questions.
I think Katie's like, okay, where can I extract good value for flights? And I suppose it goes to speak to the heart of all of us.
There's a little bit of a misnomer around that you should only book your flights on a Tuesday.
Yes, I know.
So that's a little bit of a travel myth, but there is some truth in it as well. Particularly for domestic flights, traveling in at unpopular times will be the cheapest way of doing it. So that may be 1 p.m. on a Wednesday. It may be 8 p.m. on a Friday. Like it's, it just depends on the route that you're actually taking, and it depends on how much the route is actually serviced. So if you're going in, particularly flying into regional communities, there may actually not be that many flights at all. So your choice is limited to one per day, or you know, three to five per week. So that's something that you just have to kind of weigh up and consider. In terms of international, we are getting so many more carriers come back into Australia that we're seeing prices decrease.
Okay.
We will take the big benefit of that for the summer high season for the Northern Hemisphere in 2025, because we should have the maximum amount of carriers back in the country flying on a daily basis. So that is something that also to consider, that this year might not be the year to get value for money. It may be next year, but there are deals on all the time. And I've said this on the show so many times, you need to subscribe to airline websites. And the reason you do that is they will often put the best deals up for their subscribers first before they then go out to the general public. And then once you've got your flight, unsubscribe and get rid of that email out of your inbox.
I love that, Katie. All your questions hopefully have been answered in some way. And yeah, we're always looking at getting those tips and tricks that I know, Chris, you would know. Chris, a couple more questions. Mm-hmm. Ben has asked me, I want to surprise my boyfriend for his birthday next month. Ooh. And want to treat him to Tasmania for a couple of days. What do you suggest we do? Good question, so Ben. I'm taking notes, Ben.
Ben, first of all, I hope your boyfriend's not listening. I absolutely adore Hobart as a city break destination. I think it's absolutely beautiful. If you want to do something incredibly romantic, there is Pump House Point, which is in the middle of Lake St. Clair. It's an old hydro facility at the end of a long jetty in the middle of a lake surrounded by pristine forests. There's about 20 rooms in that. It's a 1.5 hour or 2 hour drive from Hobart. Incredibly romantic, adults only kind of venue. So really beautiful if you want to do something special. The other one that I actually have dear to my heart is Launceston. I think Launceston's such a fascinating city. It's got some incredible architecture because the 70s and 80s never happened in Launceston. So they kept, all the beautiful buildings didn't get bashed down for really horrible red and orange brick things. With a really, really interesting kind of architectural city. And it's also the gateway to the Tamar Valley, which is fantastic for fun. Gate experiences, food and wine experiences, because the Tamar Valley is so renowned for its wine. So I think there are some beautiful things to do there. You'll get very, very good flight deals into Launceston as well. And particularly the low-cost carriers used Launceston as a bit more of a hub. So if you want value for money, flying in there and then potentially travelling down via car to Hobart is a great option too. Well, and then there's Wineglass Bay and Freycinet National Park and Port Arthur, and like it's amazing.
So I'm just looking at Ben's question. A couple of days, so 2-3 days. I mean, it's going to give you probably a really good feeling of all these things, and you just can not stress, just enjoy them.
And 2-3 days in Hobart, you can do things like you spend half a day to a full day at Mona, which is a museum of old and new art. That's where you can catch the ferry from downtown Hobart, do the posh pit, so do the bit where you get the champagne and stuff at the end, and you go and visit the museum, which is incredible because it's subterranean. When you get there, you realize, oh, there's a spiral staircase that goes down through the granite cliff, and then you're in an Escher painting with corridors that go left, right, and center. That's great. And you can also do an incredible kayak tour of the Derwent River as well. So if you're a little bit more active, I think that's really, really fascinating. Seeing the city from the water is really, really beautiful.
Wow. All right. That's really good. And Ben, like you want to know the answer, I've made notes. I've made notes, and even the response to Ty in Dalesford, I've made notes on your question too. Let's launch into this one. Let's just see if we could smash out really quickly. We're running out of time. Ari sent me a message. Help!
Okay.
Help! Exclamation mark. I've got a good dilemma. Mm. I'd love to spend a few weeks in Greece and want to spend it on an island or two. That's got that perfect mix of traditional, is green, has good beaches, food, and isn't too hard or expensive to get to. Any ideas? Also, when's a good time to go that won't be too busy or that expensive? Okay, so again, it's to do with cost of living. You want to keep it fairly kind of reasonable, but...
So they want out of the way and they want... I'm going to answer the second part first because that's probably the easier component. So the best time to travel to the Greek islands is late May, June, because they, the Europeans actually aren't on school holidays or break at that particular time. So you're getting really good weather, you know, the ferry systems are all running, but you're actually not inundated with crowds and it hasn't got too hot. The other alternative is you want to go at the end of the season, which is September. Again, still getting incredible weather and all those bits and pieces. But again, they've already, everybody's in Europe has gone back to work. So that's a really, really good way of doing it. My thought of the bit that's throwing me a little bit is the green. They want green in terms of their in terms of their island experience, because a lot of the Greek islands are quite barren.
It's quite dry.
So I'm actually going to the island of Seriphos, which is, and it's got a sister island, Sifnos, spending some time on Santorini and then finishing on Paros for my trip in June. Potentially places like Skiathos, which is higher up in terms of where the systems are, so you're getting more forested. This is where the places like Mamma Mia was filmed there. Okay. So, again, it's a very traditional town. Traditional island, not super expensive. You will get a little bit of value for money there, but it, you'll get that greenery that you're potentially after. If you're wanting to go somewhere that's a little bit more high-end, then probably the other side of Greece. So this is the western side of Greece, yep. So places like Corfu.
Yep.
Are definitely the way to go.
When you say higher end, you mean probably also a little bit more expensive?
Yeah, they will be. Okay. But there'll be more options though, right? Because we, when you're going to some of those smaller locations, there's less options. And definitely you want to avoid when the Greeks in particular are on holidays. So you want to avoid those late July and all of August. Just write that out.
Because I recall that a lot of the Western European countries, come the hottest part of the year, they all vacate the big cities, take their annual leave, schools are obviously closed, and head off to the coast if they can, or the mountains if they want to.
And that's when the ferries become absolutely jam-packed, feral with people and, like, you know, pushing, shoving, screaming, all that sort of stuff. But I really do think if you want that slightly more relaxed Greek authentic kind of thing, that it's definitely the months of sort of late May to through June, and then September are the way to go.
Love it. We'll have to wrap up the questions there. We've got a lot more left come in. Actually, we'll do one really quickly, one that came in. Where's the best time to visit LA?
LA, right now, actually. So LA is really good. The weather's really, really good. The next window I would suggest is actually September to November. Again, avoiding the really hot months, and which is the middle of the year. So that's summer in the States, being that, again, everybody's on their summer holidays. So it does become quite feral. So if you can't go now, then I'd wait off till sort of between September and November.
That's for you, Murray. You answered the question. Murray, let me just quickly scroll through the questions, because we got quite a few responses. Yes, it was Paul, from Murray Bridge, asked the question. Thanks, Chris, and thank you to everyone who sent those questions in. We may do this one time a bit later down the track, because I know we've got a lot of people asking us things about where to go, when to go, but also keeping in mind how to sort of make it as cost-efficient as possible.
Yeah, font of knowledge, aren't I?
You are font of knowledge. Chris, all I can sort of say is thank you so much for coming in on a Friday. A bit jet-lagged.
Oh, yeah, well, no, you're welcome.
And having a special edition of our Talking Travel segment.
Travel Thursday on Friday.
The good thing, folks, is we've got Chris in next Thursday. So next week, we're back in the hot seat.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne. Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com, or the Joy app. No matter where you are.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.